My name is Diana Dombrowski. Today is July 8th, 2011. I'm here with Bill and Carol Hemmings at the Panama Canal Conference in Orlando, Florida. If I could ask you both first, when you were in the zone, to what years?
From 46 until, really till I graduated from high school in 61.
Okay. And you?
I was there from 68 to 69.
Okay. And how did you and your family come to be in the zone?
We met in 1968 in the Miami airport. General Torrijos had just pulled his coup off and changed governments, and we didn't quite know what we were applying into. For some reason, Braniff Airlines put us up in the first class. I was flying military half fare, and somehow she got on as a student. I haven't figured that one out.
Your imagination. I was not flying as a student, but...
Anyway, we wound up in first class next to each other, and there was some engine trouble, so they evacuated the tourist class, but left the first class people aboard, which we were just about the only ones. And... serving a champagne, scotch, and so forth. So I started talking to this little girl next to me, in full uniform, big old soldier, and this little lady sitting next to me had a blanket over her knees. I thought she'd cripple. And so I was being very nice and so forth. And she...
I didn't think you were going to get into that.
She reminded me that we may not be able to get into Panama proper, because there had been a coup and the Guardia seized power. And she wanted me to take care of her until her parents got there to the airport or something happened so we'd get back to the zone, because we weren't landing in the zone.
Something I knew that he evidently didn't is that when there's any kind of revolution or coup in Panama, the last thing the party taking over wants to do is mess with the U.S. military. So a soldier in uniform would be really good protection if things got iffy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very nice to him.
That's smart.
Needless to say, we were pretty well snockered by the time we landed in Panama. We looked out the door, and there were all these armed guys out there. And seems like to me I walked off the plane pushing her in front of me as a shield. But she swears it was the other way around.
It was.
And fortunately, Carol's parents had been able to get to the airport.
Things were pretty stable by then.
And gave me a ride back to the zone, too. And so we were able to get back. And I'd managed to get her name. And being in the Pacific side of Panama, there weren't a lot of... Atlantic side. There wasn't a lot of... single eligible females around, and here I was, bachelor then. And so I called her up and started making a date. She'd come down to visit her parents. She was getting ready to move to England to give up on the States or something. And
mm-hmm.
was going to be there a month, and I just so happened to have a little sports car and a very flexible schedule, and for a day or two, she was bored as heck, too, so. And we really had a nice month touring, and it was the month of Christmas, too. I'll never forget it. We went Christmas caroling in Panama.
In the canal zone, in Margarita.
In Margarita, and weren't the dudes overhead in the space capsules? I just couldn't believe it.
I don't remember that, but.
It was 68, it had to be.
End of 68.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the astronauts were over getting ready for the moon episode.
Yeah.
And it was just so surreal to be in Panama singing Christmas carols in Margarita. that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'd come down on the USS Sturgis, which had been a converted Liberty ship left over from World War II, converted by Martin Marietta. They'd taken the propulsion system out and in place had put a 10 megawatt electrical nuclear reactor, pressurized water, and turned it into a floating reactor, nuclear reactor. And this was the world's first. It was more done as R&D under the Army program, U.S. Army Engineer Reactor Group. And this was a tri-service organization made of Army, Navy, and Air Force personnel. The Army operated it. Had a bunch of plants, small plants, more, let's say, R&D type plants. We had one down in Antarctica, one in, had one in Greenland, one in Alaska, one in Sundance, Wyoming, one in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And this floating one, which was trying to prove a concept, it would have been very relevant for like the Japanese disaster today, to be able to tow a generator, big generating capacity plant, dock it next to the disaster area and feed in the electrical lines and you have power. One of the problems they had in Japan, they lost power for days and days and days.
That would have been perfect, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And so anyway, the canal had been experiencing drought, and Pan Canal needs water to work because of the hydraulics. And so electrical power for the Panama Canal had been provided extensively by the dam down in Gatun.
All the power was hydroelectric.
Oh, okay.
And so they wanted to save the water, not use the hydro power, so that's one of the reasons we thought, oh, we'll bring this reactor down there, it doesn't take water, and just, you know.
Yeah.
And so we brought her down, towed her down, I think it was April 68, and the crew came down, and it was about 45 of us, I believe, in the crew on it, and nuclear operators. I was a health physicist, I was trained as a nuclear operator, but I got the job of environmental monitoring, which meant that I would take water samples around the boat, sediment samples from underneath the boat. Then I would go out in the jungles and gather biomass, fish, things like that. Then I'd go out in the lake and catch fish and so forth and ash them down and do radiological analyses of these samples and then send out a report every month and every quarter and so forth like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
bottom line, he got to spend his days hunting and fishing in the canals around the lake.
Yeah.
It was the ideal job in the Army. In fact, the big picture, this was a program put on by the U.S. Army back in the 60s, 70s, actually came down and filmed me. It's one of the more interesting jobs
in the Army. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Thank the signal photograph of me sitting on the end of the pier with a fishing pole, but easiest job in the Army. It's quite nice. And then Carol left after a month and went back to England. And a couple months later, I was due to get out of the Army. I'd been in 8 years and it was time to get out. And so I decided to take my leave time, and I went to England to see her and went over for a couple of weeks and came back to Panama. And the Army had guaranteed my right to drive back up from Panama through Central America, give me enough time to do it.
Okay.
And so when time came, they let me out, and I drove all the way up through Central America back to Texas to get out of the Army in 69. So it's a real trip for me. Back then it was a different world out there. it was an interesting tour and working on the reactor and everything, and thing worked fine for us. Now, an interesting story happened after that.
Okay.
It's when they, I think it was 74, somewhere around there. I was out of the Army and lost contact, but they'd shut her down, the reactor, and was going to take her back to the States. And so they had a small crew on board, just watchmen and so forth, and it had to be towed by tugboats. It was just a big Liberty ship, no power. And they were advised against it because it was hurricane season, but they went ahead and did it anyway. and there was a big storm off Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. Is it South Carolina? Where's Cape Hatteras?
Doesn't matter.
One of the Carolinas. And really bad storm, and they had to cut the towboats loose because there was about, they thought the ship was going to sink, and they didn't want to tow and taking boats down with it. And they brought in helicopters to get the crew off. And last man got off, and the ship rolled over to its side. And they thought for sure it was gone. But somehow she righted herself, and later on they were able to connect the tow cables up again and get her in. But the ship was severely, the innards of the ship, the reactor portions inside were severely damaged. It was never used again.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's, I think last I heard of it, she was in the mothball fleet up in James River in Virginia, I think. But somewhere up there, anyway, if they haven't decommissioned it. Anyway, it proved the concept that you could build a floating nuclear reactor and it could be towed someplace and hooked up and so forth, but then they didn't pursue it. It was research development. I understand now the Russians are actually doing it, building floating things for disaster areas. You stow them in, hook them up, you got power.
Yeah.
And a massive amount, you don't have to run the fuel oil in. So.
Would have saved Fukushima, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well.
But anyway, that's that was my
I didn't
my
know
experience.
Anything about that. Yeah.
You know, most people don't. They don't talk about it. They don't, you know, it's not like it's top secret or anything.
No.
It's just they don't, it's just not something they flash out.
So the nuclear reactor came down in 68 and provided electricity for the zone until 79?
Somewhere in the 70s. I was
handed
gone.
Handed over? Yeah. Okay.
You know, probably damn near a decade.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And you mentioned your job was pretty unique. Like, the only one doing that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. The only one in the Army, really, for a floating nuclear plant.
Yeah.
During that time.
Yeah. But it was set down in Gatun Lake right next to the dam, hydro dam there.
Hmm.
I don't know if you were familiar with the zone.
Well, a bit.
Yeah.
A bit, yeah.
It's where the dam was. It was pulled up right up along there. That's where we based the ship, or the barge, I'm supposed to call it.
Hmm. Did you notice any drastic environmental effects?
Well, there seemed to be a slight buildup of cesium underneath the ship for a while because the moss on the bottom is acting as a filter for our effluents, which you're allowed by law to let small amounts of contaminated materials go out, you know. A certain amount, it's measured, you can't go above a certain level with the intent that it'll just disappear once it gets out in a bigger environment. But we have by our exit point, there was a lot of moss. I guess it liked radiation, I don't know. But it probably liked the heat.
Sucked it up, huh?
But we had to keep the moss out of there, or else it'd act as a filter and would concentrate the minute amounts within limits, but it was just, it was noticeable. That was my job, to pick up any slight variations and report it. So we instituted a program to get rid of the moss and so forth like that. That was the only thing I ever picked up that was weird.
Wow.
And, so no, it operated totally within the prescribed legal lines. We were inspected by the Nuclear Regulatory, or back then the Atomic Energy Commission. And so, you know, everything we said, it had to be true or else, you know, we're not only subject to the military, but the federal government and everything and other laws pertaining to nuclear power. So we didn't, you know, snudge any figures there. They were all what we saw. And basically, I had to sign it, so nobody knew what I was signing anyway. So it was fine. Everything was on the up and up.
Okay.
Good crew, excellent crew.
So the reactor was able to provide electricity for the entire zone? Or was it supplementing?
You know, it probably was supplemental because we had to bring down another barge. It wasn't nuclear. This one was a gas turbine, a high-speed gas turbine. And we brought that down and put it on the other side of the canal and detached a small detachment to work that. And so between them, they provide a large percent of the power for the zone. I can't give you accurate numbers. I don't remember.
Okay.
And
yeah.
The actual power production, I wasn't dealing with too much.
Randy Deakins would know.
Yeah.
Because he worked on the dam.
Yeah.
You know, how many megawatts they generated.
Yeah.
There were two dams. It was Madden and Gatun.
Mm-hmm.
So the other one would have been hooked up at Madden.
Yeah. The Gatun Dam was the one they were worried about because that was when they lost the water once they left the lagoon. They couldn't use it for the locks anymore.
Right.
But basically, I understand they're having problems again with the lack of rainfall down in Columbia, though.
And now they're building that
third lock.
Third locks will be interesting.
Wow. Well, the questions that I had prepared, you both can answer, but your answers will probably be different. What were living conditions like for you when you were in the zone? Where did you live? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's probably more relevant for me.
Okay.
Because we went down in 1946, shortly after the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was two, so I don't really remember much, but I can remember my mother complaining a lot about not being able to get fresh food. At one point, my dad bought a bunch of live chickens because the meat was so bad. So they got chickens and kept them in a coop behind the house. And he was a farm boy, so when they wanted chicken, he went out and killed a chicken. Just to have good meat.
Mm-hmm.
And and it was hard to get fresh milk. I remember they kept trying to give me powdered milk and I wouldn't drink it. Klim.
Yeah, I've heard that
you
name.
Probably heard about Klim.
Yeah.
All of us who were kids would remember it. It was nasty. But somehow they did get fresh milk.
Okay.
I don't know how. But, so I don't know. I never had my own bedroom till I was seven.
Okay.
I think a lot of people lived in very small quarters. And I was an only child. So when I say my own bed, we were in one bedroom apartments until I was seven. But that was typical. Nobody, you know, it was normal. But it was nice.
Mm-hmm. Did you live in the multifamily housing?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, unless you had a really big family, you didn't get single family housing until you had been there maybe 10 years.
Yeah.
It was all by service, you know, how long you served.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved. We were there from 46 to 51, and then is it okay to just jump around here?
Yeah.
From in 51, when we went there, every little town had its own dispensary with a doctor and at least one doctor and dentist and a pharmacist. And my dad was a pharmacist. And so in 51, they closed all the little dispensaries and moved everything to Coca-Cola Hospital and Gorgas Hospital. So they laid off a lot of doctors and dentists and pharmacists. And whoever had the least seniority was the first to go, and that was my dad in the case of Coakley. We lived in Coakley.
Mm.
So we went back to the States for 3 years, and then they called him up and said, "Do you want to come back?" And he said, "Yes." So where was I going with that?
Living where you live.
Anyway, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So the whole time we were there, we were in a 12 family, which my mother always called a bat roost. The 12 family bat roost. She hated it.
Yeah.
And it was basically just a single room. You know, big, like a studio apartment with little divisions between living, bedroom, kitchen, front to back, like the old shotgun houses. So we were there for I don't even remember how long, maybe a year. And then we moved to a four family house that had a separate bedroom and living, dining, and kitchen. So, and then we moved to, after Daddy had been there about 5 years, we were able to move to a two-bedroom, four-family apartment.
Bigger and bigger.
And that's when we left.
Okay.
And then when we came back, we were on the Pacific side. And when we came back, we went to the Atlantic side, and my dad was at Coca-Cola Hospital. And then we had a big house. I guess Gatun wasn't so much in demand because we had three bedrooms and big porch. It was two family house.
Okay.
So Mama was much happier with that.
I heard the Atlantic side was a little less populated or more rural.
Oh,
is
yeah.
that the case? Okay.
Yeah, probably. Well, given that Balboa High had about three times as many kids in the graduating class as we did, must have been about three times as many people over there.
Mm-hmm.
That's Pacific side.
Okay, yeah.
So. Okay.
Okay. Let's see, what else?
To live there too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we go. First came down, I was in the barracks at Fort Sherman.
In Panama?
Yeah.
Sherman?
I think it was Sherman.
No, we were at Davis.
Was it Davis?
Fort Davis, yeah, Sherman was
or
across.
Fort is in Sherman, that's
across
right.
the canal and the...
Then Davis, went to Davis, and then living in the barracks there, and then some of us got together and was able to get the vacation housing when the canal zone people would go back to the States every couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Vacation. We lived in vacation quarters when we first went to the Atlantic
people
side.
People take a couple of months off every so often, go back to the States, and they need somebody to watch the place or
got a paid,
take care of the dog.
Paid 2 month vacation every 2 years.
Wow.
And yeah, people would rent out their house.
Okay.
And so me and two other buddies, army buddies, took over one and near Gatun and. Party time. And of course, you couldn't do anything in the zone, especially on the Atlantic side. It was just so small, and everybody knew who you were just about, or something like that. So you had to be somewhat civil and law-abiding.
Darn.
Yeah, the Canal Zone police did not tolerate a lot of nonsense.
No, they did not. They didn't tolerate me well either.
I dare say.
But we had our peace. So.
Well, you knew how not to get caught. Anyway.
Wow. it sounds like there's a couple of stories.
Still claim
he wasn't that bad.
I was almost arrested by Noriega. I think he was at...
Well, that was in Panama, or
yeah,
Colón.
Colón, I think that when Torres took over, all the GIs were supposed to stay on in the zone. They weren't supposed to go out in Panama proper. It was off limits. Of course, that was just incentive for me to go into Panama. Say, don't go. And I'd run into some friends of mine, high school friend, who was contracting down in the zone, working on some of the housing. And I'd met him at a bar, and then the police came in, and I swear the Guardia guy, officer, was Noriega.
Yeah.
And
maybe.
He was with the American military police. And of course, the civilians got to get out, and I got cornered, and they were going to bust me. And
were you in uniform?
No, I was in the civvies, and... This happened to a young lady that was at the table knew somebody and talked him out of it or something like that, let me get out the back door. But the other guy went in, got court-martialed for it.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that wasn't really bad. Well, I think he got 2 weeks restricted quarters or something like that. Yeah.
Still?
Yeah. That's Panama. That was interesting times.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
Texas.
Oh, okay.
So cool. I was used to the heat, but not all the green.
Yeah.
And I love the fishing. It was great fishing. My wildlife was wonderful. I had to go out and see the caiman and everything else. There were some of the jungle areas I went through had there weren't gators, there were caiman, the snakes.
There, I don't know that I ever saw one, but there were supposed to be several caiman living under the dock we used to water ski from. Nobody really worried about it.
Well, good. Okay. I'm glad.
It didn't really bother people.
What was your school experience like?
School?
Yeah.
School.
Okay.
You said it was miserable.
I would have been miserable anywhere. So I don't know if that's relevant. One thing, I went to Cristobal High School.
Okay.
And there were, let's see, what year was that? 59 or 60, there were riots in Panama.
Yeah.
And I remember we were bused through Colon to get to high school because the high school was in New Cristobal, which is surrounded by Colon. And I don't remember being real nervous about it myself, but I remember my mother being terrified for me to be going driving through Panama at that time. And there were days we couldn't go to school because of the riots.
Wow.
At least that's the way I remember it. That we got out of school because there were riots in Colón. Other than that, the old Cristobal High was a beautiful building. I remember that. They had there were two big courtyards with palm trees, and somebody brought in a big boa constrictor and we had him in the biology classroom.
Cool.
At least 6 or 8 feet. And one of the girls formed a real relationship with the boa. They were, she was the main one who took care of him. They were very close. She used to take him out in the patio, and it was a snake. He would go up in the palm trees and enjoy the fresh air, which is probably not your typical high school experience.
Oh, it sounds a little dangerous.
Yeah. He did bite her once. But it was just a scratch on her cheek. I remember that.
Okay.
But they, it wasn't big enough to tackle a human being.
Oh, okay.
But it's probably about, 3 inches in diameter and 6 or 8 feet long.
Okay, yeah.
Because he was taller than, about the height of a grown man, so 6 feet.
Yeah.
Big snake. That's the size of the one I was going to jump out of the car and capture for you. You said it was a bushmaster and it kind of froze in midair and came back into the car.
That reminds me of another funny story from my childhood. I don't know if this is the kind of thing you're interested in.
It is.
But as I say, my dad was a pharmacist at the little local dispensary, and the doctor there was, I don't know, but he had been out drinking somewhere one night. There was a lot of drinking in the canal zone.
Okay.
A lot of alcoholism. And so, which is not to say that I don't know, I just know he was out drinking that night and probably shouldn't have been driving. Mm-hmm. On the way home, there was this big sloth by the side of the road.
Oh.
And in his state, he thought it would be really fun to get the sloth, and he took it, wrapped it in a sheet or blanket or something that he had in the car, and threw it in the back of the car, brought it home, and put it on the dresser. This is the story I heard from, probably from my dad. Puts this big thing on the dresser, and the sloth, being a sloth, just sat there till morning. And when his wife woke up, there's this
thing
on the dresser. She was not real happy. I think they may have divorced later, but probably not just because of the sloth. Yeah. And anyway, so he took the sloth and put it out in front of the house. He had a duplex. So the sloth was out front, and he had a collar or something, rope. So all the neighborhood kids went to see the sloth. And these things have claws probably about the size of my two first fingers. And they can actually slash very quickly if they're annoyed enough, even though they are very slow otherwise.
Yeah.
So here's all these little kids, and I remember the sloth as being almost as big as I was, because I couldn't have been more than five, probably less. And it was, you know, by this time he was pretty annoyed, so he was doing, you know, slashing with his claws, and all these little kids are getting as close as they can.
That sounds
dangerous. People were a lot more casual about their children then. We used to go play in the jungle and swing from the vines and pretend we were Tarzan. And the jungle was right across the street from the house.
Okay.
And so we'd go down in there in the little ravines. And
that sounds fun.
And, oh, yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
We then a big boy started taking pets. So we were, after that, we weren't allowed to go, at least I wasn't allowed to go in the jungle anymore. I think there may have been one or two little boys whose parents encouraged them. Go out there. Have fun. Don't come back till whenever. But yeah, that kind of restricted our jungle play.
Yeah. That's pretty unique. You wouldn't have done that in the States. I'm sure it's in the jungle
back
and boa
then,
constrictors.
Well, there weren't any jungles.
Yeah.
But kids were just much less sheltered.
Okay.
What was 60 years ago?
Kids weren't.
Well, you used to go out and chase mountain lions, for Pete's sake, in Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
Accidentally.
By accident, but yeah. Just out running in the woods or the jungle or wherever.
Woods in Texas.
Yeah.
Wow. Well.
So, what else?
Did you play any sports growing up there? Okay.
Straight A student until you get to that one.
No, I always had C's in gym and A's in everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah.
No, I was a great aggravation to my gym teachers. Wanted no part of it.
Yeah, I do know what that's like. How did you celebrate your holidays? I've heard a lot about Christmas tree burning.
Oh, the Christmas tree burns, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The ship would come in with all the Christmas trees, and you probably heard the Christmas tree ship.
Yeah.
They do the same thing in Hawaii.
Yeah.
The Christmas tree ship is a big deal when it comes to Matson. I worked for Matson till I retired.
Okay.
But, holidays. I don't know. When we first were there, I guess Christmas decorations were kind of hard to come by. I remember my mother made soapsud snow one year. She took ivory flakes and whipped up this snow out of soapsuds and put it on the tree.
Oh.
And it stripped all the paint off the ornaments, which is why I remember it, because it destroyed all our ornaments.
Oh.
But she was upset about that because it was hard to get it was just hard to get stuff.
Okay.
Back then, the commissaries weren't very well stocked, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that changed later, although it was always very limited. Another, should I tell the story about the dentist's daughter and the Capizio shoes?
Why not?
I told you that. This was when I was in high school, jumping around again, and one of my friends was the daughter of a dentist, and I always tell Bill it was kind of a classless society down there, because everybody had a job, and everybody had a pretty good job, and there weren't any real, and your quarters, unless you were head of the locks or something like that, your quarters were based on service, years of service, rather than what you could pay, rather than your job. Or if you had a big family, or if you had a really important job, those were the only exceptions. So everybody had the same houses, and you had to shop in the commissary, so you had the same clothes. And one of my friends, her father was a dentist, and had, you know, they had more money, and she used to complain about how she would go to the States and get fancier clothes than the rest of us had, and nobody cared. We didn't know, you know?
Yeah.
And if she was, you know, if she couldn't get things from the States, she was complaining that something about Capizio shoes were the thing to have back then, and you couldn't get them in the commissary, and so nobody had them and nobody cared. And that kind of aggravated her. She couldn't really display her status. Yeah. This isn't going...
No,
I can just see her hearing this somewhere and going, "Ah, damn, Carol."
Well, it so keeping up with trends wasn't really that important to you or your classmates and like the States?
Not really. We were way behind, and we knew it. And I think, as kids, we cared, but there wasn't a lot we could do about it. So it didn't matter.
It's always very nice the way the Zonies would accept military people. Not totally, but pretty much.
Oh, yeah.
You know, weren't a part of the Zone, but subset.
Just kind of cycled through.
Yeah.
I remember in high school, there was a kind of social thing between the girls, this is by late high school, the girls who dated enlisted men, it was a sort of three-level thing, girls who dated enlisted men, and then girls who dated high school boys, and then there were a few girls who dated officers, military officers by senior year or so, and somehow that was, they thought they were a little above the rest of us.
So you're pretty close to a military base, or was there military living around you?
There were, on the Atlantic side, there were, three military bases, and all, you know.
Okay.
There's little separate communities, there were, three, four little separate communities, and then there would be separate communities that were military bases.
Okay.
But we all went to the same schools. Now, is that... I think the military kids went to the Canal Zone elementary schools as well. Pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, we all went to the same school. There were two high schools, one on the Atlantic side, one on the Pacific side.
Okay.
And so it was pretty well integrated. We were all friends. We kind of knew the military kids wouldn't be there that long.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty well integrated. Yeah.
Did you decide to go to college in the States?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. I know that's a little further ahead, but where did you decide to go?
Stanford.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Cool. Okay.
It was, I remember we had vacationed in California 1 year, and I saw Stanford from the train, actually, and decided I wanted to go there.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So I did. It was far from home. I like that.
Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts or feelings about the turnover of the canal to Panama when that eventually happened?
Well, I never believed the Panamanians could run it.
Okay. Yeah,
I still don't.
Yeah, well, yeah. But there they are.
There they are.
A little help from the Chinese.
I mean, I always felt wrong that the way we took the canal, but, you know, it was quasi-legal at the time. It was built, and I always felt a little like a colonialist down there. We had this nice 50-mile-wide strip that was clean, the grass was cut, and, you know, everything was perfect. And then you step across the line, you had the filth of Panama. And all these little shacks and shanty towns.
And I'll say, as a Zonian, I felt that the canal zone compared to the wealthy areas of Panama was, there was as big a gap as there was between the canal zone and the poor areas of Panama.
Yeah.
Hmm. So, well, you know, wealthy suburbs of Panama made the canal zone look shabby.
Well, I know. But
I never really felt
that guilty. But you mixed with that other crew, didn't I? I just basically saw the interaction along the border and the town, the bars and so forth.
Yeah, and you saw Colon, which is the poorest part.
I will say I had no trouble in Panama, even off, you know, even Panama at night, drinking, I never had any problem.
Well, you're big.
People were always very nice. And,
Well, they were, sure. And,
good tour for me. Love going out to Portobello.
Yeah.
How important was Panamanian culture or interacting with Panamanians? You know, how did that affect your life at all? Was it really, like, isolated from the rest of the country for you?
Oh, yes and no.
Okay.
You'll have gotten that my mother was always a little paranoid about things.
Yeah.
But, so we didn't travel into the interior as much as a lot of people did.
Okay.
We went to the beach, Santa Clara, Gorgona. And that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
We had Panamanian, probably about my parents' closest friends were Panamanian citizens, but they were Austrian.
Oh.
So Austrian by birth, but and my best friend was one of their children.
Okay.
And so they lived in Panama in a big house with servants, lots of servants. And we had Panamanian friends. Went to carnival and, you know, but not really a lot of contact with Panamanian culture.
Okay.
I'd say.
They limited mine pretty much down in Cologne with the bars, the B-girls and everything.
Oh, God.
I was a soldier, honey.
You were a soldier.
There wasn't a lot of action in the zone.
Yeah. And a lot of... Particularly, I guess on both sides, a lot of wealthier Panamanians sent their children to the Canal Zone schools. So we had Panamanian friends in school. But again, the wealthier class.
Because they had to pay tuition?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and middle class. A lot of, like, the pharmacist who worked with Daddy was Panamanian. And his kids went to Canal Zone schools, and they lived in Panama.
Hmm.
But so middle to upper class Panamanians.
Yeah, okay.
I think the really wealthy ones sent their kids to the States.
Probably, yeah.
We can liberate lanes.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I actually went out once or twice with a couple of Panamanian guys at Stanford.
Yeah.
But didn't work out.
It appears so, yeah. Those are actually all of my questions. Are there any other memories you guys would like to share, things we haven't covered?
I think we talk about a bunch of them.
Well, yeah. Huh? Oh, can't talk of, yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're not talking about those. let me think. I don't know. It's just, I don't think I ever really appreciated what a good childhood I had.
Really?
We had a lot of freedom. And you know, it was very safe.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a small town in the U.S. would have been equally safe. But it was very, just very safe, very comfortable life,
mm-hmm.
really. And limited in a lot of ways, which I always struggled against. Everybody knew what you were doing and who you were and what you were doing. And
yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, in junior high, we would, you know, a group of girls, my friends, would take fishing poles and go down to the little pond by the railroad station and go fishing, or go to the Gatun Yacht Club and just, I don't know who they even belonged to, grab a cayuca and paddle out into the lake, and as we got older, go out and wave at the sailors on the ships. And, you know, no life jackets, no nothing. We could all swim really well, of course. But, you know, we'd paddle out and do that. And
that sounds fun.
Take our bicycles and go across the canal at the locks and go cycling up to the dam or all around.
Tarpon Club?
Tarpon Club. I don't know. We never went to the Tarpon Club much. It was a little far because you had to come cycle back up that big hill. But just, you know, just kind of bat around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we've taken an hour here, so.
Yeah, we've done our hour.
Okay.
Thank you. I hope to get some use out of it.
Yeah, I think we will.